This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Yesterday, President Bush submitted to Congress his budget for the fiscal year 2005 at $2.4 billion. The budget will result in a $521 billion deficit. Many politicians and some economists say the record amount of red ink could cause interest rates to rise and bring a halt to an already fragile recovery. And after 4 years of surpluses between 1998 and 2001, many fear the nation has returned to the habit of deficit spending, which could lead to greater national debt. Are they right? Well, some economists say no. They say deficits can actually help a weak economy, that sometimes it pays to spend now in order to bring prosperity later. Figuring out one's own finances can be confusing, but the nation's? We're going to try to understand how the nation's finances work a bit better today. Later on, an update on the discovery of the deadly poison ricin in a Senate office. This hour, the national debt versus the deficit. What's the difference, and do they matter? Do phrases like balanced budget and growing national debt leave you confused? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Here to give us an economic primer is Mike Santoli. He's senior editor at Barron's Magazine. He joins us from his office in New York City. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Mike.
Thanks very much. Glad to be with you.
Let's start with a basic question. Okay. What's the difference between debt and deficit?
Well, the deficit, as it's referred to when talking about the federal budget, is the amount that the government expects to spend this year in excess of the amount of tax revenue it brings in. So basically, it's this year's shortfall in making the budget. And the debt is the overall amount that the government owes by basically having deficits year after year after year. So as you mentioned, the expected deficit for the current fiscal year ending in 2004 is going to be in the area of $500 billion. The total debt, the total amount that the government owes as it's built up those deficits over the years, is about $7 trillion. So every year the deficit, if there is a deficit, adds to the total debt.
So the deficit is money that you don't have to pay off what you owe in a given year.
In
right?
a given year.
Okay. So when the government doesn't have enough money to pay for everything it wants or owes, where does it get the money?
It borrows it, and it borrows it in the form of treasury bonds, treasury securities that it sells to investors. So effectively, it borrows the money from the public, and that would be the public both in this country and across the world.
Does it pay interest the way the rest of us do?
Certainly does. It pays interest, and it, in fact, pays interest according to what the market determines the interest rates to be. In other words, the government would love to pay as low as an interest rate as possible, but if they set the rate too low, then they wouldn't sell enough of it to cover their shortfall. So currently, like as we speak right now, the government's 10-year loans, so 10-year Treasury securities, are carrying an interest rate in the area of 4.1%. So obviously the government gets to borrow, the U.S. government gets to borrow at rates much lower than anybody else, essentially, simply because their creditworthiness, their ability to, if they had to, go out and print dollars, basically makes people pretty sure that they're the safest of all possible credit risks.
But the government, like the individual, is the government often paying off not its debt, but the interest on its debt more than the debt itself?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the government really has, except when they were running surpluses in the budget instead of deficits, the government is typically only really paying off the interest. In fact, I believe in the proposed budget, the net interest on the debt for the coming year, according to the president's budget, is going to be in the area of $177 billion for next fiscal year. So that's, you know, it's indeed one of the biggest individual expense items in any budget that the government proposes is the interest on the debt that's outstanding.
So, in essence, in borrowing to make up for the deficit, the government accumulates debt.
That's right.
Okay. And how does the government pay off its debt?
Well, the only way it can pay it off is if it brings in more money than it's going to spend in an individual year. And as you mentioned, you know, for a few years, there were surpluses that were run. And in those cases, you can reduce the amount of borrowing you have to do, and perhaps pay down the debt by some level. So that's the way it can get on top of it. Now, I should emphasize, I mean, I don't believe there are many people out there that say the government cannot sustain, the current level of debt. It certainly can continue to service this debt for a long time. So it's not as if there's a priority among many people in government or out of government to say we have to get it down to zero, and because there's really no way to see clear to doing that anytime soon.
Yeah. Now, in talking about deficits, when a budget comes out and they start projecting deficits, I mean, it's based on projections that are not always right, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, and there's good reasons for that, because there are so many assumptions you have to make in terms of what the government's expenses are going to be and the amount of taxes they're going to be able to pull in, that obviously there's a lot of play in those numbers. Because, for example, anybody proposing a budget has to estimate the rate of economic growth. It's going to tell you how much people earn, how much companies profit, and those are the things by which the tax revenue is determined. So clearly, nobody can perfectly predict economic growth, stock market levels, which also contribute to how much gets paid in taxes. And for that matter, on the expense side, various types of social services clearly are variable based on just the economy, other circumstances, Medicare expenses, for example. So it's not something that's a precise science, although the numbers are big enough that you can kind of build in some reasonable comfort with the numbers, you know, within a certain margin of error. The problem comes in, I guess, if certain people want to go with a extremely optimistic economic growth estimate, for example, which is going to make it look like the deficits are going to be smaller in the future than, in fact, they are likely to be.
Yeah. Now, the president's budget projects a record deficit, but only in actual numbers, not really in percentage of the gross national product. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the actual dollar figure is going to be most likely higher than it's ever been before, but the economy overall is bigger. Right now, it's about the U.S. Gross domestic product, the size of one year's economic output, the sales of goods and services, is about $10.5 trillion. So as a percentage of the economy, it's going to be in the area of what that comes out to, I guess, about 5%, a little bit under that, actually. And in the past, it has been somewhat higher than that in the early 90s, for example, when there was also kind of an acknowledged idea that there was possibly a fiscal crisis going on. So that's one of the reasons that you'll hear people say, well, you know, the budget does seem like a tremendous number, but it's not something that we haven't dealt with before, and the economy is big enough that it can handle this level of deficit.
The president says this deficit is going to be cut in half by 2009. How?
Well, according to his proposal, it's going to rely on various things such as, economic growth estimates, for one thing, are going to be something that the president will say, well, that's going to generate a level of revenues that's going to help offset the expenses. It's also, the key point about this budget is that the attempt is to try and restrain the growth in what they call discretionary spending to, in this budget, less than 1% for the next year. Now, discretionary spending means everything that doesn't include national defense, I believe Homeland Security they're including in that as well as entitlement programs such as Medicare, Social Security benefits. So what that means is all other, you might think of them as cabinet departments, whether it be education, Department of Justice, many, many kinds of programs, the EPA, will be the areas where they're going to try to slow down the spending to below the rate of economic growth. And that...
It really amounts to a cutback, doesn't it?
Certainly. Well, it'll amount to a cutback in I guess, when you account for inflation and economic growth. Exactly. It's going to reduce the relative size of those programs.
Yeah. The president wants to reduce the deficit but does not want to roll back tax cuts. Is it possible to have it both ways?
Well, you know, not only not want to roll back tax cuts, but is also, of course, proposing to make many of the tax cuts that have already been passed permanent. That would be an additional cost in terms of revenue that is not accounted for in the current budget. Well, you say, is it possible? Certainly, it's possible, but it would entail much greater restraint on spending than is currently contemplated, right here in most budgets. We should also say that, you know, as everything, as we know about everything in Washington, it's not so much something that the president proposes and gets done. Clearly, you know, this has to go through the process of congressional debate, and it's generally assumed that many of the proposed cuts won't end up happening. So, you know, it's one of these things where, as it seems right now, it's not, there's much justified skepticism as to whether the deficit can, in fact, be cut in half in 5 years without additional sources of tax revenue.
We have a question here from Ralph in Orchard Park, New York. It's an email, one of my personal favorite economic questions here for you, Mike. Why does the federal government borrow money rather than print it to meet short-term monetary needs?
Well, it's the government certainly likes to have some backing to its to the currency. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily want to go out and literally print money. It would really cause massive inflation, most likely, and reduce the value of those dollars in a way that you don't necessarily want to do. So it really does need to. I mean, we do need to pay for what we're doing as opposed to just print it. When I was talking earlier about printing the money, I mean, in secondary ways, there are ways to effectively expand the supply of money. It's complicated, but the Federal Reserve does this by having interest rates extremely low. They are bolstering the supply of available money or investable money. But it's really not necessarily a tenable strategy to strictly go out and I mean, because eventually, I mean, taken to its extreme, that process does literally make the money worth no more than the paper it's printed on.
All right, let's see if we can get a call in here before you have to go. John in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I found on the Internet the Treasury, treasury.gov, has a website that was real interesting. The deficit last year for fiscal year 2003 was $374 billion. And if I understand the fiscal year, it starts on October 1st. The Treasury Department has a site where you can look up the national debt on any given date. So what I did was I went and I entered October 1st, 2002, and looked up the debt. And then I looked up the debt on October 1st of 2003 and just subtracted the two different debts. And I expected that to be the deficit because the debt was increased by X amount of dollars. But it turned out the debt was increased by $589 billion, not $374 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a $215 billion difference between what was published as the the deficit for 2003 and $215 billion more was actually increased on the national debt.
Okay. Is anybody as confused as I am at this
moment? Okay. Yeah. I mean, without knowing for sure, my guess is that effectively, you know, interest compounding on the existing debt is most likely going to be responsible for that. So in other words, the government not only borrows this year to make up for the shortfall, which is comprised of the deficit, but it will also refinance existing debt or take on more debt to cover, you know, interest payments. So I'm guessing that's really what we're talking about right there.
Shouldn't they really publish that then and say that the deficit is actually the $589 billion number?
Honestly, I don't know the technicalities of the government's accounting, but arguably, yeah, that's kind of what was going on. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a gray area in terms of exactly, you know, one individual year's deficit is just simply a snapshot. I mean, the government's spending money every day. As you know, budgets don't get passed on the day that the last one expired very often. So, I mean, the government's spending money, and it's sort of putting on paper what it says the deficit is. But, yeah, arguably, you know, you'd want to basically have a full accounting of basically how much more in the hole the government got during a given year.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, John. If you have any questions about the role of the two Ds on our economic well-being, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a talk at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Debts and deficits do matter, but the question is just how. Joining us now is someone who thinks a budget deficit can be good for America. He is Kevin Hassett, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and he joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Kevin.
Thanks a lot, Lynn.
A lot of people tend to think of deficit spending as a bad thing. Why would you say that that's not necessarily so?
Well, I think that you have to think about why you're running a deficit. And there are times, I think, when most economists agree that it's not such a bad idea to run a deficit. I can even say that I've been on television programs with Secretary Reich from the Clinton administration where he generally agreed with me on this point. So it's not a controversial view that, say, if you're in a recession, then one way you can get the economy rolling again is to cut taxes and increase spending. And, you know, that generally leads to more output and more job creation and so on. And, you know, you could even go back to President Herbert Walker Bush's record back in 1990 when we had a recession. He adopted a kind of anti-deficit tax policy, which was to raise taxes and cut spending during a recession. And I think most economists now agree that that policy is responsible for the prolonged slowdown that we experienced back then. And so it's somewhat ironic that President Clinton became president in part because it's the economy, stupid, and the stupid policy that led to the success of that strategy was one that looked a lot like Reaganomics. It was, you know, higher taxes and lower spending. So in the near term, you can benefit a lot from having a deficit. But in the long term, you have to remember that if you spend money, then you're going to pay it. You're either going to pay it now or you're going to pay it later. You know, if you pay it later, then you're going to have interest payments between now and then.
Well, is there such a thing as a healthy amount of debt or a healthy amount of deficit?
Well, I can tell you that relative to GDP, the U.S. is not a startlingly high country. Like, we don't stick out in the deficit Olympics at all. And in fact, relative to GDP, the Japanese have almost quadruple the level of debt that we do. Now, it's not a wonderful economy over in Japan, but it's not, you know, high interest rates that have caused the demise of their economy that we've seen over the last couple of decades. And so, you know, we don't know for sure what the level of debt is that's troublesome. But, you know, most countries on Earth that are developed have levels that are equal to what we have now or greater.
Well, my next question was going to be, when is it too much? I mean, you're saying
we don't know. We don't know, but I think that the linkage between, you know, today's deficit and potential economic harm is so weak in the scientific literature that discussion of that issue in some sense distracts us from what the real question is. And I think the real question is, you know, is the spending that we're doing today, you know, a sensible thing to do, because we're going to either pay for it today or we're going to pay for it tomorrow. Either we're going to pay for it or, you know, we're going to have to raise taxes ultimately and our kids are going to pay for it, or our kids are going to pay interest payments to cover the debts that we incurred today because of, you know, the spending that we decide to do. And so really, I think that the deficits are appropriately a question of intergenerational equity. You know, the question is, you know, am I doing something today that my kids would want me to do because, you know, their money in part is going to pay for it? And I think if we focus on that debate, then it would help us think about, you know, things we should spend money on and things we shouldn't in a much better way than the current debate does, which I think inappropriately focuses on some kind of chimerical near-term economic harm that deficits cause. I mean, after all, you know, the economy is growing at a very high rate right now. Interest rates are very low and way lower than they were a couple of years ago when, you know, the deficit alarmists were saying the Bush tax cuts were going to increase interest rates. And so, you know, we should ignore those short-term things and think about the long-term questions.
But hasn't it always been Republicans who have called for balanced budgets, fiscal responsibility? I mean, how does this record deficit fit within the Republican philosophy?
Oh, you know, you hit the nail on the head there, Lynn. And in fact, if you go back to the famous contract with America, I think the first element was a balanced budget. So, you know, there's definitely been a long history of Republicans arguing for, you know, small deficits or even balanced budgets. But I've studied this in some detail and have found that, in fact, the deficit tends to be the argument used by the opposition, whoever that might be. And so if the Democrats have power today, then the Republicans will be deficit hawks, and they'll say, oh, we can't have deficits. And if the Republicans have power today, then the Democrats become deficit hawks. And I think the reason why that happens is that very often both parties have things that appeal to a lot of people. So, you know, the Republicans might be saying to lots of folks, look, we think you should be able to keep more of your money. You know, it's kind of hard to argue against that if you're a Democrat by saying, oh, no, I want to have more of your money. But it's easier to say, oh, well, but the deficits might be really harmful. And, you know, on the flip side, the Democrats might offer some program that many people would like, and the Republicans might not want to argue against the program directly. But if they say, oh, think of the deficits, then again, they might be able to rally support against it. And so the deficit is something used by political opportunists, and it flips back and forth across parties. And I think the reason it can do that is that you don't really see the near-term harm that the alarmists mentioned. If you did, I think that deficits would be much more effective in terms of defining a political identity.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good talking to you, Lynn.
Kevin Hassett is Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. We're talking about debt and deficits. And with us still is Mike Santoli. He's Senior Editor at Barron's Magazine. And, Mike, we're going to try and get some calls in now. I'd like to go to Bill. He's in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My question is this. In this President's State of the Union address, he said that he was going to cut the deficit in half in 5 years. But the guest, Ken, was saying that the deficits are run every year, and so and the debt is what is accumulating. So my question is this: was the president really speaking as to cutting the debt in half, or cutting last year's deficit in half?
Well, yeah, he was talking about cutting the annual size of the deficit in half. In other words, there would continue to be annual deficits in each of the next 5 years. But what he was saying is, by cutting discretionary spending growth, that by the fifth year, the deficit that year would be half as big as this year's.
You know what? I'm wondering, Mike, and thanks so much for your call, Bill.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you have this figure right at hand, but maybe to make it clearer, the difference between debt and deficit, maybe you could tell us what the national debt is.
Oh, it's about $7 trillion.
Okay, and the deficit, this year's deficit?
Somewhere around $500 billion.
Okay, so for those of you who are still confused about debt and deficit, that gives you an idea.
Exactly.
But if we continue deficit spending at the rate we're doing right now, where might that debt go in the coming years?
Those estimates can kind of reach the sky depending on your assumptions. And I think what's also very important, and it's a complicating factor, but it's important to recognize that when we talk about the deficit, whether it be, you know, the $500 billion deficit that was contained within the projected budget that the president submitted or not, that is effectively understated in its size, mainly because it's sort of making use of the revenue that comes in for Social Security payroll taxes. And that is an amount that basically the government is using it now, even though it's theoretically going into some kind of a trust fund. There's no trust fund with money in it. It's basically a accounting device that we're using the money. We have an excess today that comes in for Social Security taxes versus what's paid out this year in Social Security benefits. But come around 2010, that dynamic reverses. So what that means is, at that point, we're going to owe more in Social Security than workers are paying into Social Security in the form of payroll taxes. Now, what does that mean? It means you no longer have the benefit of that surplus that you can play with this year to make the deficit look smaller and the debt, of course, seem smaller, but you actually are going to have to start paying out of pocket. And I think that nobody would argue that deficits make some sense in certain many economic conditions, and you want to have the government to try to promote economic growth. The problem is, you know, as the debt gets bigger and you dig yourself into a somewhat of a bigger hole, if you keep the Social Security promises that the government is now making, it sort of ties the hands of the government when it is at that point going to need to spend a lot more money than it pulls in. So that's kind of the time bomb aspect of it that people worry about. It's not really a matter of next year or the year after. It's a matter of what our behavior today does to make tomorrow much harder.
Mike Santoli is senior editor at Barron's Magazine, and joining us now is Henry Aaron. He is senior fellow for economic studies at the Brookings Institution. He thinks that growing budget deficits and debts are cause for concern, and he joins us from his office in Washington, D.C. Henry, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Did you hear what Kevin Hassett had to say earlier?
Yes, I did.
I wonder if you could respond to his thesis.
The deficit is a problem not because it is large this year, but because it is going to persist and grow larger into the future, even after the economy has recovered. It's not a problem this year because much of the budget shortfall is attributable to the fact that business is down. Individual incomes didn't grow as much as they would have if we had not had a recession. And consequently, revenues are lower than they would be if we were at full employment. So having the deficit actually helps in the near term because it means the government is spending more than it is withdrawing from the economy and is helping maintain economic activity. So far, what Mr. Hassett said is okay. From there on, it's not. Looking ahead, the budget is going to be in a very sizable deficit, even after the economy returns to full employment, and the administration's claim that it is going to fall by half over the next 5 years really shouldn't be taken seriously for a couple of reasons. To start with, even if, according to the administration's own projection, if it did nothing at all, the deficit would fall because of economic recovery by more than it says it will. So the net effect of the administration's proposals as they report them is to increase the deficit, not lower it. The second point is that there's an awful lot missing from the administration's budget estimates. Let me give you perhaps the most glaring example. The administration is in favor of making the tax cuts enacted in 2001 and 2003 permanent, but there's another provision of the tax law called the alternative minimum tax, something that's enough to make you put on your green eye shade, but it's going to be something that's scheduled to affect tens of millions of Americans, and its effect will be to prevent them from getting the benefits promised by the tax cuts enacted in 2001 and 2003. So the administration has promised that it will change the alternative minimum tax to reduce its bite. But it doesn't price that out. It doesn't include the cost of those corrections in its budget estimates.
Mr. Ann, let me ask you something about debt quickly. Who's financing our debt?
Mostly we are. That is, most of the debt that the government sells, it sells to Americans, insurance companies, banks, pension funds. A fair bit and a rising proportion goes to foreigners now. And it's that rising proportion that's held abroad that is one source of concern about increases in the level of the debt.
What does it mean to be a debtor country?
Well, it means you're spending more than you are collecting in revenue. In this case, the United States is importing and buying from others a lot more than it's selling to them. And its assets abroad, that is, assets of all American individuals and businesses, that are located overseas, that is, the amount of foreign businesses and that we own, is smaller than the proportion of U.S. businesses that foreigners own. And we're now a debtor country to the tune of well over $1 trillion, but rising at the rate of about $500 billion a year.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Aaron.
You bet.
Henry Aaron is a senior fellow for economic studies at the Brookings Institution. He joined us from his office in Washington, D.C. And with us still is Mike Santoli, senior editor at Barron's Magazine. And let me just read an email to you, Mike, and see if you can respond to this. Isn't the only reason for the falling deficits of the 90s simply because the surplus came from falling interest rates, reducing debt payments, and nothing else?
No, that's not really true. I mean, for one thing, there was a tax increase back in the very beginning of the first Clinton administration that helped. Largely, though, it was because the economy was in its longest phase of expansion ever, and that kind of raised tax revenue more than anticipated at the beginning of the period. And the stock market boom shouldn't be underestimated either. Stock market boom created tremendous amounts of capital gains, which ended up being kind of a windfall revenue source for the government because they didn't budget for those kinds of gains. So that was a large part of it. Certainly, though, the lower interest rates, without a doubt, did lessen the burden of the new debt that was issued each year by the government. I mean, that you have to keep that in mind. I mean, you know, there's still you know, Treasury securities that were issued, you know, well back into the 80s at high rates of interest. Now, the government likes to try to refinance those in times of lower rates, but a lot of that stuff might remain outstanding. So you're still paying previously high rates, but it's true. New borrowing was at much lower cost during the 90s.
We're talking about debt and deficits, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to go to Evelyn. She's in Houston, Texas. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Good, yes. I would like to ask Mike, please, I have two questions, actually, but my first is, how does the government continued borrowing and running a debt and deficit compare to a household where a family may have high credit card debt and then has to not only earn money to pay off the principal on that debt, but may get further and further behind with the interest payments?
Evelyn, I think we're only going to have time to answer that one question. So,
well, the other one ties into it, and I wonder if I can possibly...
Very fast, if you want one answered.
Okay, well, the other thing is I have a concern about that, and I have looked at the policy of, for example, Wes Clark, and he has a policy position to pay this down by raising...
Evelyn, I'm going to... You know what? We're going to run out of time, honestly, so I'm going to
ask
our guest to answer that question.
Right. Well, okay? Well, look, I mean, with about $500 million deficit this year and a, let's say, $2.3 trillion budget, it shows you that this year's additional debt is about more than one quarter of this year's family budget, let's say. So that's a fairly high number. Another way of looking at it is $7 trillion in total national debt is almost 70% of an annual earnings, which is the total economic output of the country. So it's pretty high by all those standards, although not necessarily very high if somebody just bought a house, for example, and just took on a tremendous amount of debt that looks big compared to today's earnings.
And with that buying a house example, which I think is a good one, I mean, that's a good example of where debt is good. For most people, taking on that debt ends up being a good thing.
Absolutely. No, debt allows you to do things you otherwise would not be able to do. And as long as it's done on a manageable level of interest and expense, then certainly it's the wise thing to do.
And arguably, it's the debt that many people have taken on with their homes that's keeping the American economy floating at this point.
Oh, yeah. It's an incredibly flexible economy, and it's managed to really find its way into people's pockets as well.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike Santoli is the senior editor at Barron's Magazine. When we come back, an update on the discovery of the poison ricin in a congressional mailroom. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.